line. And I think we can't allow a few extremists to use the kind of demagoguery that confuses this issue. After Sandy Hook, I think the data showed that about 90% of Americans, believe it or not, supported some level of reasonable gun reform, and still it did not happen. And it's because the other issue that's driving this issue is the vast and inordinate influence of money in politics. Too often we have the best politicians that money can buy, and that, for me, is a moral issue. But somehow, moral voices, people of goodwill, have to stand up and speak truth to power. It's our democracy that we have to reclaim in a moment like this.
We want to thank you both for being with us, especially on this day, Juneteenth. That's right, June 19th in 1865 was the day that African Americans in Texas learned 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation that the slaves had been freed. That does it for our broadcast. Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, Colin Goddard, thanks for joining us. I'll be speaking in Custer, Wisconsin, Saturday at 1 o'clock. Democracy Now! Is hiring a senior news producer and engagement editor. Find out all the details at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO, the time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Hi, I'm John Schack, host of Religion for Life. This week, I wrap up my three-part series on how to read the Bible. The most important step is to give yourself permission to disagree with it. Jennifer Grace Bird is the author of Permission Granted. Take the Bible into your own hands. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Food Wars 8, hosted by Clinton Street Theater. This annual music and comedy festival is also a food drive and will feature entertainment from August in Blue, Bad Habit, Tragedy, Boomer, Belinda Carroll, and more. Again, that's Food Wars 8, Sunday, June 21st at 5 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, and this program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lent's International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm, every Sunday at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Lent's Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community produce booth open to home gardeners, cooking demos, and live music. More at lentsfarmersmarket.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
The gunman who killed 9 worshipers in a Charleston church appeared in court today.
A former Portland strip club operator has been charged with crimes related to sex trafficking.
And whistleblowers in the FEC have been accused of trying to profit from the 2016 election. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 19th, 2015. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Ryan Stroyer. The gunman who killed 9 people in an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, appeared in court today. Family members of the victims looked at Dylan Roof as he sat shackled and addressed him directly. Here is a part of the court hearing in Charleston.
Is there a representative of any of the family that would be here that wished to make a statement before this court before I post or set the bond? You are representing the family of Ethel Lance, is that correct? And you are whom, ma'am?
The daughter.
your daughter. I'm listening, and you can talk to me.
I just want everybody to know, to you, I forgive you. You took something very precious away from me. I will never talk to her ever again. I will never be able to hold her again. But I forgive you. And have mercy on your soul. You hurt me. You hurt a lot of people. But God forgive you. And I forgive you.
Representative of the family of Myra Thompson.
You know, I forgive you and my family forgive you. But we would like you to take this opportunity to repent. Repent. Confess. Give your life to the one who matters the most, Christ, so that he can change it, can change your ways no matter what happened to you, and you'll be okay. Do that, and you'll be better off than what you are right now.
Taiwan Sanders.
Felicia Sanders.
Thank you, Ms. Sanders, for being here.
We welcome you Wednesday night in our Bible study with open arms. You have killed some of the most beautifulest people that I know. Every fiber in my body hurts. And I'll never be the same. Tawanza Sanders is my son, but Tawanza was my hero. Tawanza was my hero. But as we say in Bible study, we enjoyed you, but may God have mercy on you.
Your name, ma'am?
Alana Simmons.
Thank you, Ms. Simmons, for being here. Your statement, please.
Although my grandfather and the other victims died at the hands of hate, this is proof. Everyone's plea for your soul is proof that they lived in love and their legacies will live in love. So hate won't win. And I just want to thank the courts for making sure that hate doesn't win.
Thank you, ma'am, for being here. Your name, please, ma'am?
It's Amy Milton Brown.
Thank you for being here.
The pain doctor was my sister. And I too thank you on the behalf of my family for not allowing hate to win. For me, I'm a work in progress, and I acknowledge that I am very angry. But one thing the pain has always joined in our family with is that she taught me that we are the family that love built.
We have no room for hate, so we have to forgive. I pray God on your soul, and I also thank God that I won't be around when your judgment day comes with him. May God bless you.
Ms. Wilson, is there anything that you wish to tell the court?
No, sir, Your Honor. I just wanted to make it clear for those who aren't familiar, again, with that process, that you don't have authority to set bond on the murder charges, so that's why you aren't addressing those.
Reverend Graylin Hagler from Washington, D.C., spoke with KBOO today about the importance of white people addressing the issue of systemic racism and white supremacy in our society.
The reality is you got places and you got segments in this country that are still fighting the Civil War. We're upset that you have elected a black person to the White House who really feel that black people and people of color have somehow taken over. And basically those in power continue to help foster that kind of ideology and perspective because it operates towards the ends of racial violence and keeping people separate, basically creating the kind of economic paradigm where a few are able to remain rich and get richer at the expense of all the rest. And that you also have whites who will even vote and act against their own economic interests in order to keep the oppression of black people and other people of color alive. So one of the ways that steps that we take is that white folks, liberal white folks, as well as conservative white folks, need to deal with their own institutions that continue to propagate and hold up white supremacy paradigms. You need to take on your churches. You need to take on your social clubs. You need to take on the institutions and the groups that continue to foster basically white culture and white lifestyle and white perspective. It's only white folks that can deal with that. And so white folks have to deal with that if they're really concerned about this. Somebody asked me if they can put together a group of whites to stand on the steps of my church on Sunday as we worship so that they can protect us. White folks have not protected us, cannot protect us, will not protect us. The ideology of white folks is entirely built upon this ideology of dominance, very often telling lies in order to try to maintain fear and really to mobilize institutions and systems against people of color. You see it in terms of police violence taking place in this country. You see it in terms of the prison system that is basically filled and filling with people of color because you cannot work a population when you don't have jobs on your shores any longer.
Comedian Jon Stewart last night told his audience that he was unable to be funny or come up with any jokes after what happened in Charleston.
I honestly have nothing other than just sadness. Once again, that we have to peer into the abyss of the depraved violence that we do to each other in the nexus of a just gaping racial wound that will not heal, yet we pretend doesn't exist. And this is a terrorist attack. This is a violent attack on the Emanuel Church in South Carolina, which is a symbol for the black community. It has stood in that part of Charleston for 100 and some years and has been attacked viciously many times, as many black churches have. And to pretend that, I heard someone on the news say, well, tragedy has visited this church. This wasn't a tornado. This was a racist. This was a guy with a Rhodesia badge on his sweater. You know, so the idea that we're, you know, I hate to even use this pun, but this one is black and white. There's no nuance here. This is.
Dylan Roof has been charged with 9 counts of murder. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley says she wants Roof to receive the death penalty.
Portland City Commissioner Amanda Fritz has filed a $9.5 million lawsuit against the driver who hit her husband, Stephen Fritz's car, and killed him on impact. The lawsuit claims the driver of the car, Michael Lippman, was driving too fast on I-5 during a heavy rain when he lost control of his vehicle, crossed the median, and struck Stephen Fritz's car. Family members of Carrie Fairchild, the passenger also killed as a result of the crash, filed a lawsuit against Lippman as well as the Oregon Department of Transportation. The lawsuit claims that ODOT failed to prevent the crash by delaying the installation of a cable barrier, a barrier that it was set to be built, has been set to be built since 1996. Fritz's lawsuit seeks $9.4 million in compensation for pain and suffering, loss of income, memorial expenses, and loss of companionship. Earlier this month, Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed a bill that gives ODOT 6 years to build median barriers along particularly dangerous stretches of I-5.
Stagehands with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Southern Oregon have voted to form a union. The 71 workers have created a new local with the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. They represent just a small portion of the nearly 600 people employed by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which is a large economic engine for Ashland and the whole region. According to the Northwest Labor Press, in the final weeks before the vote, the administration of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival held anti-union meetings at which crew members were served bran muffins and paid for their time. At the meetings, the managers painted the union as an outside third party and suggested that employees would be under the direction of a powerful union president if they voted for unionization. Management flyers posted in the workplace also framed the election as a vote of confidence in management, claiming that workers should vote no if they believe managers have done a great job and are trying to close the pay gap. Union supporters rejected that framework, saying that managers are doing a fine job, but workers want a voice in setting the terms and conditions of their employment. In the end, 3/5 of the workers voted for the union. The 71 newly unionized stagehands work on lighting, video, sound, wardrobe, and stage production for the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
The Oregon Domestic Workers Bill of Rights was signed into law by Governor Kate Brown Wednesday. It grants new labor rights to nannies, housekeepers, and home cleaners. The bill grants domestic workers rights to overtime pay, breaks, paid personal time off, and protections against sexual harassment. Oregon now joins New York, California, Hawaii, and Massachusetts in explicitly protecting domestic workers under similar standards to those applied to workers in general. State Senator Sarah Gelser of Corvallis, a sponsor of the bill, said domestic laborers had been left behind and were especially vulnerable to labor rights abuse and violations. Domestic workers' rights, or rather domestic workers' wages, are still based on the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour rather than on Oregon's minimum wage of $9.25 an hour. According to a national survey by the University of Illinois at Chicago, a quarter of domestic workers earned less than their state's minimum wage. Roughly a third said they worked long hours without breaks, and a quarter of those fired said they were dismissed for complaining about working conditions. Advocate Kate Newhall testified in the legislature in support of the bill.
Kate Newhall, please.
Thank you, Chair Hovey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today representing Family Forward Oregon. We are happy to be here today in support of Senate Bill 552 and believe that it provides a very basic measure of protection for domestic workers. Domestic workers are some of the most vulnerable workers in our state and country, and an overwhelming 95% of those domestic workers are women. They do a job. They provide care for our family members that requires complex skills, a great deal of compassion, and often very, very long hours. We're here today to support Senate Bill 552 so that these workers do have some protections to a break and to overtime and protection from sexual harassment. I will say, even though we're happy to be here supporting 552, I think you heard before you some of the ways that domestic workers are still excluded from Oregon wage and hour law and minimum wage and our meal and rest period protections. I think the protections that are in Senate Bill 552 are very important to add for these domestic workers. I also think they're not the same protections that are available for every other worker in Oregon under our current wage and hour law. So with that said, we are happy to support 552. I think it is a step towards making sure that these workers that care for our families are protected.
The city of Portland has over $30 million in unpaid parking violations with no easy way to collect the funds. Over 190,000 parking tickets are listed as unpaid in the past 10 years. The city's current method of collecting these unpaid fines relies on towing the violator's car. People can then pay fines to get their car back. In Oregon, refusing to pay a parking ticket is not illegal, but failing to do so increases the fine substantially. People whose cars have been towed can face fines that are more than the value of the car. The Oregonian pointed out that this system can be considered a modern-day debtor's prison. People need their cars to get to work, yet they can't afford to pay off increased citations. It is a growing problem in Oregon, especially for government, as they struggle to get funding to build and repair roads.
Lawrence Owen, a former Portland strip club operator, is charged with conspiracy to promote prostitution and hiding funds from the IRS. Owen was arrested in February for promoting illegal prostitution in 11 different adult entertainment businesses. The arrest follows a Portland police undercover operation, finding that in 18 out of 21 strip clubs, the police officer could pay for prostitution services. Grand jury testimonies claim Owen knew, promoted, and managed prostitution activities and regularly solicited services for himself. Portland has the most strip clubs per capita of any major city in the U.S., and these businesses routinely facilitate prostitution and, in some cases, sex trafficking. Portland is the second worst city in the U.S. for sex trafficking, making it very dangerous for at-risk youth, particularly young girls. KBOO News reporter Catherine Matichek spoke with Avital Balwit from Youth Ending Slavery about the current state of sex trafficking in Portland.
I'm speaking with Avital Balwit from the organization Youth Ending Slavery, a youth organization dedicated to combating human slavery on the local, national, and international level. Thanks for being with me today, Avital.
Yes, thank you so much for inviting me.
So could you talk a little bit about the climate of sex trafficking in Portland and why Portland is such a hub for this type of crime?
Portland is one of the major hubs in the U.S. for sex trafficking, and this can be attributed to several things. First, we're on the I-5 corridor, so it's really easy to traffic girls down from Seattle all the way through Portland to major cities in California. Also, we have a large transient population, and that is very easy to find victims in runaway youth communities. And so Portland, having a large homeless population, it's easy for traffickers to pick off from that group. Also, we have a fairly unregulated adult industry, and that can be fronts for trafficking. And so all of those contribute to Portland having a very high rate of human trafficking.
Could you talk a little bit about the runaway youth situation? And I have a statistic here from your website, youthendingslavery.org, that runaway youth will be approached by a human trafficker within 72 hours of being on the street.
That is far too common, having runaways be almost immediately picked up. And I mean, the solution to that really is just having more shelters, especially shelters for women and shelters for youth.
Could you talk a little bit about what makes people susceptible to human trafficking and what we can do to mitigate the effect?
Yeah, it's very sad that traffickers often do target already vulnerable communities. They target communities that may not have a great relationship with the law enforcement, because then victims won't be as likely to go and seek out help from law enforcement because they can't necessarily trust them. Also, lower-income communities, sometimes those people are more desperate, and so they'll take a job even though it may not seem perfectly safe or high-paying, because often victims are lured in with a promise of a job dancing, or maybe even just a promise of any kind of job, and then they will be taken for trafficking. And so traffickers know to look for people that lack safety nets and people that are in need of money. They know how to find already vulnerable people and manipulate them.
Could you speak a little bit to the process of how pimps attract different victims of human trafficking from the point of contact? Are they told about the nature of the work they will be doing, or are they lied to? What does the process look like?
Typically, they are lied to. Traffickers often pose as boyfriends or as friends, and they can either win them over first by pretending to they sort of woo them, and sometimes they'll say, well, if you love me, you'll do this for me because the rent's due and we don't have any money. And so they can use that sort of emotional manipulation, or they can just straight up lie and say that they have a different kind of job for them. They can say, you're going to be selling magazines with me. You just need to come with me to this other city. And so it can be, it's almost always deception. People are rarely told what kind of work they will be doing.
If people do witness signs of human trafficking, and if people want to learn about what those signs are, could you direct them to different resources that they could research?
Yeah, so our website, youthendingslavery.org, has a lot of great statistics. And obviously, there are other great websites out there like the Polaris Project. And the Polaris Project also runs the Human Trafficking Hotline, which is a great number to put in your phone if you ever witness trafficking, because that is the number you should call. So I think that people just don't really know what to look for. They see someone that looks, a young person that looks lost or homeless, and that child really needs help. And people just kind of chalk them off to, like, being druggies or, bad kids. We hear that word a lot. And really, those are kids in danger. And even adults, if you go on 82nd, that's a street where it's very visible. But, I mean, even just downtown, throughout the entire city, it is very likely that we have seen trafficked people in our everyday lives.
Thank you so much, Avital, for taking time to speak with me today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I have been speaking with Avital Balwit from the organization Youth Ending Slavery, a youth-focused organization on stopping human trafficking on the local, national, and international levels. This is Catherine Maticek with KBOO News.
Hotter than usual water temperatures in the Willamette River are leading to a die-off of Chinook salmon. Spring Chinook salmon typically die in the fall after they have spawned. This year, Chinook are dying earlier than usual. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Tom Friesen from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Without conducting any specific study in the short time frame, the only thing that we can conclude is it's the very early and very high water temperatures throughout the Willamette Basin. The question is how many fish are being affected by the really hot temperatures in the main stem. Usually we're not even looking for this pre-spawning mortality until like July. But this year it's occurred much earlier.
And can you talk about how the salmon start and where they go during their life cycle in the course of a year?
Sure, yeah. There's a lot of different life history pathways, we refer to them, that they take. But in general, most of the juvenile fish are leaving the system in the spring and head to the estuary and the ocean. The adults start coming back to the basin as early as February or March. They peak passing Willamette Falls in April, May, and then they are engineered to stay in the basin tributaries until they spawn in mid to late September. So that's pretty critical here to have good water conditions in those rivers while they're waiting to spawn.
What's the temperature that these Chinook salmon are able to withstand as far as water temperature?
It depends on how you look at it, but most of the literature says that they stop migrating at about 70 degrees. If they're exposed to 70 degrees for a long time, they'll start to die. Right now, we're seeing temperatures at Willamette Falls of about 75 degrees.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Tom Friesen. He is with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife about the high water temperatures causing a early mortality this year for Chinook salmon in the Willamette River and tributaries. Thanks for joining us today, Tom Friesen.
Thanks for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Scientists from Oregon are exploring what looks like the largest algae bloom ever recorded off the Pacific coast. The toxic algae stretches from California to Canada. It's suspected to be caused by the extremely warm temperatures in the Pacific Ocean. Offshore temperatures are 2 degrees higher than normal. The algae bloom is impacting numerous species, including shellfish, crabs, and sea lions. Meteorologists gathered recently at a global conference in Sweden. They predicted an increase in toxic algae blooms around the world due to climate change.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses on at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy, with lows of 68 in the early morning and highs nearing 79 in the late afternoon. Today in history. In 1846, the New York Baseball Club and the Knickerbockers played the first officially recorded game of organized baseball. The Communications Act of 1934 established the Federal Communications Commission, or FCC. In 1957, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were executed for espionage. They were accused of giving the Soviet Union information about the atomic bomb. The quote for the day is from feminist thinker Bell Hooks. Our freedom is sweet. It will be sweeter when we are all free.
Oregon Democrats may repeal the state's clean fuels program in order to fund transportation. Republicans had promised to block any deal until the clean fuels program was withdrawn. Sources close to the negotiations leaked details to the Oregonians saying that Democrats, including Governor Kate Brown, agreed to the compromise. Governor Brown's office said that a win-win solution could be reached, but environmental groups have already come out against repealing the clean fuels program. To learn more, KBOO producer Alan Montesillo spoke with Jana Gastelum from the Oregon Environmental Council.
For people who might not be familiar with the Clean Fuels Program, could you explain exactly how it works and, if repealed, how it would affect Oregon?
Yeah, the Clean Fuels Program really holds the oil industry accountable for its climate pollution. It requires that they make investments to reduce pollution in a gradual way over time, but in a meaningful way. And it judges all fuels based on their lifetime carbon emissions and then allows them to compete on that playing field. And so the program, as it's designed and has been adopted into law, really rewards the best players. It prevents backsliding, so that if higher carbon oil comes into Oregon, like tar sands, then that's accounted for, and it's measured and it's monitored. So it's a really smart and well-designed program. The alternative appears to fall far short. First of all, it looks like it lets the oil industry off the hook. It relies primarily on voluntary measures, which don't guarantee pollution reduction or clean air benefits. And it shifts that that responsibility off of the oil industry and onto taxpayer-funded programs. And all we've seen really is what has been leaked into the media. We haven't seen anything presented on paper. We haven't seen any detailed analysis. So this is based on whatever little bits of information are being leaked into the media from those closed-door negotiations. Sure. There really hasn't been stakeholder input, and certainly not from clean fuel providers who, you know, are really ready to help Oregon meet this new standard.
Right.
So it looks like it's saying, oil companies, you're off the hook, and somehow we'll find new dollars or reappropriate existing dollars from taxpayer or other funds.
I guess in an ideal scenario, Governor Brown gets the transportation bill and keeps the clean fuels program, correct?
That's right. And it really, from what, again, what we've read in the media, it looks like some of these component pieces have come from the oil industry itself, which is, it's not based here in Oregon. It's out-of-state special interests. And so we would hope that the governor would stand up to those out-of-state interests. In 2009, a transportation package and clean fuels was passed in the same year. There's no reason why Oregon shouldn't have both clean air and better roads. I think we can do both.